Hello, everyone. What comes to mind when you think of a great place to work? Companies like Google and Costco? Cut policies like generous vacation packages, great health benefits, and paid maternity and paternity leave? Or maybe quirky environments with ample social spaces or air hockey tables? There is solid evidence that better workplaces make happier workers. That fact is key to helping your federation recruit and retain top talent and increase productivity, especially at these critical social senior levels. But when everyone has their own idea of what a great office looks like, where do you begin? I'm Judy Silverman from the Jacksonville Jewish Federation, and I am pleased to introduce you today to a distinguished group of experts who will help us learn to cultivate and positive cultures and connections with our federations. Golly Cooks is the inaugural executive director of Leading Edge, Jewish Leadership Pipelines Alliance, which influences, inspires, and enables dramatic change in attracting and developing and retaining top talent for Jewish organizations. Mimi Kravitz is Chief Talent Officer at Hillel International. And there is a third page somewhere here. And Scott Kaufman is CEO of the Jewish Federation of Metropolitan Detroit. Our moderator today is Alyssa Mayer. She is the Vice President of JFNA's Mandel Center for Leadership Excellence. And don't forget, you can play the GA and win a trip to Israel. Download the app now from the App Store, turn on your Bluetooth, and earn points by checking in to each session and taking a survey afterwards. The survey will appear in the session description on the app once our session is over. Now, this is the most important thing. If you've got questions, don't ask me about what I just read, but go to the GA help desk. They will have your answers. So get in the game, and Alyssa, the session is yours.
Judy. Thanks, Judy. Mort Mandel, in his book, It's All About Who, speaks about what he calls a pivotal business moment for him, something which touched him on an emotional level. He tells a story about a particular company in Israel. It's called Phoenicia Glass. It's located in Yerucham, which is a small town in the Negev. And he looked into purchasing this pretty poor shape company. They had a high rate of turnover, a really bad sense of morale from the professionals, the employees who were there. Profits were declining, and his CEO, his business manager in Israel, said to him, "What are you looking at this company for?" And he said, "I'm looking at it because I see an opportunity to truly advance this company, great growth opportunity." And he said, "And here's what I'm going to tell you. If we change the management, if we invest in the people who are working there, we are going to turn this company around." And sure enough, exactly what he did, the recipe for success. Brought in a new CEO. What's the first thing the CEO did? Met with the employees who for years had been telling their management the problems that they were experiencing in their factory line and what could be done to improve it, but nobody listened to them. The new CEO listened to them, made improvements, invested in the equipment, but not only invested in the equipment, invested in the people who worked in this factory, made it a better place to work. He invested in things, in creating better equipment. He invested in creating a better environment. One of the things that Moore tells in his book, as he tells the story, he said, you know, when he was there and he was doing a factory tour, and by the way, he said this is his secret, he does it all the time, he asks to use the restroom while on tour. And typically what will happen, they'll say, "Oh, let us take you to the executive office." And he says, "No, no, okay, we're right here, happy to go to the restroom right on the factory floor. And they were, of course, mortified, embarrassed, because the conditions were deplorable. So what did he do? He changed that with the new manager. And so now this company is a huge success. But more importantly is not only the impact that it's had on that particular company, but the impact that it's had on the entire town. I had the privilege, I think it was 2 years ago now, 2 years ago, right, Joni? A fundraising university group, a group that we run through the Mandel Center of really top talented fundraising professionals, and we invest in their professional development and growth. I could think of no better way to show the importance of investing in people than by visiting this factory. And when we were there, the factory workers were so happy to tell us their story and to tell us how it had impacted their lives. But most importantly, they really wanted to show us this beautiful olive tree that they planted in honor of the person they revere the most, Mort Mandel, because of the investment he made in their company and in their town. And it was just a beautiful moment. Now, I tell you this story for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think it frames what we're going to be talking about for the next little while. It talks about how by investing in people, by investing in workplace culture, you can truly change the course of an organization, profit or not-for-profit. And that's a powerful message. But here's another powerful message about that. Mort Mandel, as you know, we are the Mandel Center of JF&A, is a visionary leader who, along with a handful of other leaders in the Jewish community, have made it a priority to invest in human capital, both professional and volunteers. And Mort, through his work through our Mandel Center at JF&A, through Mandel Centers and federations in Israel and in JCCs all across, he said, I'm going to make the Jewish community better and stronger by investing in the people. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So as we started thinking about this session, we wanted to take a pulse a little bit. And we wanted to see, what do Federation employees across the country, what do they say are the most important attributes for creating a great place to work? And so we sent out this list. Lonnie and Karen, they're going to hand it out so you can, I know it's hard to read from here, they're going to pass around the list of what we gave. We gave 15 attributes of a workplace culture, and we asked them to rank what are the top five in terms of creating a great place to work. And I know there are people in this room who have participated in this survey. Thank you. Thank you, Karen. And now here comes the audience participation part. You know how usually when you come into a session, everyone tells you, put away your phone? I'm going to ask you to take out your phone for a moment. Okay? And here is what I want you to do. I want to get a sense of what you think, not what you believe for yourself, but what you think Federation employees across the country identified as the top five priorities. And here is how you're going to do it. You have that list in front of you. You are going to text to the number 22333. Okay? And then when it comes up, you'll get a box, and then you put in JFNAGA. Okay, so everybody do that first, and then we'll go on with the instructions. And while we do that, I'm going to go on to the poll, hopefully. Yes, 22333. It's coming up. It's showing on my screen here, but it's not showing my screen there. Or maybe I have to do it. Okay. While he works on the technical things, here's your job. You can start doing your inputting while you're doing it. I want you to, on your papers, there's numbers 1 through 15. You just text in the five numbers for your five top choices. So if you think it's 1, 3, 8, 11, 12, I'm making it up, and you don't need to just put in the numbers. That's all you have to put in the line of the text, okay? And we're going to see the results right up here as you do it. So you just put in the numbers, put in 1, comma 2, comma 3, whatever your numbers are. And again, you remember you're doing it. What do you think people chose? And you should have a sheet in front of you which you can read easier. I see people straining. Does anyone need a sheet? Is it working? No, I'm checking with them. Okay, we'll give it a minute. We'll give it a minute. Oh, are we not getting service? Service is Hilton Honors, and then if you put in JFNA 15. No, shouldn't need that. The Wi-Fi service is, we'll give it a minute. We'll see if it works. If not, we'll move on, but we'll try. What's up? Just put them in like 1, comma, 5, comma. You don't even need the comma. You can put a space in between. It worked either way. If it works, we should start seeing lines up here. If it doesn't, we'll move on. Karen. No? Okay, never mind. Next. Wait. Oh, it is working? Okay. And then you're putting in the numbers? All right, in the meantime, here's what I'm going to do. We'll come back to this in a minute. Okay? No. All right. Lonnie, do you want to call Jennifer? Okay, we'll come back to that. So in the meantime, oh, wait, we need to go out of this now. Thank you. Sorry, technical. We'll be able to backtrack to this if it works, and we'll compare the answers. But for now, we'll take a look at... And you, did you put the numbers in? You can put the, you can, it worked both ways when we tried it. I know, but we can't get the PowerPoints missing. That's the next issue. We're moving on to the next. We're just waiting for the PowerPoint to come back so I can show you the results. How about this? I'm going to tell you the results as we wait for the PowerPoint to come back. What about that for an idea? Okay. So the top five answers that were submitted, and you can compare to what you put in and how this relates, and we'll see if it was what you expected. Number one, employees feel valued, recognized, and appreciated. How many of you had those in your top five? We're going to do it the old-fashioned polling way. I'm not reading them in order. I'm telling you what the five top answers were. So how many people had, by a show of hands so everyone can look around, employees feel valued, recognized, and appreciated? I think your results validate the survey results. That was number one. Number two, there is a strong sense of teamwork and common goals. How many people had that in their top five? Okay. Mixed, not as high a number. Number three, opportunities exist for professional growth and development. How many people had that? Number four, open communications, transparency exists from senior leaders. How many had that in their answers? Okay. And number five, employees believe in organization's mission and values. There you go. So those were the top five answers. So interestingly, when you do employee surveys like this, often people believe that what drives people to feel valued and appreciated in their place of work, and typically if you ask people what would they think that the number one answer would be, they would believe that you're driven by monetary compensation. And on our survey, when we did it, and our survey results are not different than many of the other results given, monetary compensation was way down, not way down, but it's the brown line right over here. employees are awarded fair things. And benefits was almost down all the way at the bottom. So that gives you a sense of what people are looking for in the workplace. So for the next few minutes, what we're going to do is you're going to hear from our great panel who are going to talk to us about three different areas of this. Golly Cooks is going to speak about why. Why is it important to invest in our workplace to make them a better place to work? Mimi Kravitz, who has a varied experience coming from the for-profit world and now transitioning into the not-for-profit world, is going to bring us some expertise from truly one of the most well-respected companies in terms of their workplace culture, consistently on the top 100 companies of a great place to work, Google. And she's going to speak about what it takes to make a great place to work. And then we have our case study of how it really makes a difference within our own system. And we have Scott Kaufman, CEO of Detroit. He's going to use what he has done, how he's invested in changing the environment in Detroit and the results that it has yielded. So now, Golly.
Thank you, Alyssa. Okay. So, wow, the room filled up after my last look back. As Alyssa mentioned, I'm going to be talking about the why. Why every Jewish organization should become a great place to work. I should mention why is my favorite question, my favorite Jewish question. So I was very pleased that I got to do this piece. Mimi will talk about how, and Scott will actually take us into a real life example. I'm going to go through three basic steps about why Jewish organizations, why every Jewish organization should become a great place to work. One is we're going to talk about the cost of not being a great place to work and actually talking about it in a business case perspective. We'll talk about the benefit of organizations that actually have taken steps toward becoming a great place to work. And then we're going to look through it in a Jewish lens and talk about the Jewish values case for why every Jewish organization should be a great place to work. And we're going to do that in 10 minutes. I promise. So let's first, if we're talking about great places to work, let's first start with work. Let's start with work. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 9 out of every 24-hour days is spent at work. So out of your waking hours, they do assume that people still sleep 8 hours, which I take issue with many different of those, right? We're talking over half of your waking hours are spent at work. Now, let's look at what exactly we talk about when we think of the work experience currently. So Gallup basically puts workers in two big buckets. And there are other buckets, but I'm going to simplify and just say the engaged bucket and the not engaged bucket. And we're going to get into the cost, essentially, what this means exactly in terms of productivity. So the engaged is exactly what we read up here, right? These are people who work with purpose. These are people who are deeply aligned with the organization's mission. They are people who don't balk when you say, can you do this one thing that's not in your job description? They are people who kind of have a constant thread of the kind of work that they do, and they think about the kinds of problems and opportunities and programs and services, and they're just inspired by the work that they do. Can anyone think of these types of people in your organization? Yeah, raise your hand if you can think of these people. Thank God. Good. And my sense is the plurality of this room is made up of these exact kind of engaged, fire in the belly, real passion and purpose aligned with values kind of people. That's the first bucket. Then there's the not engaged. This I like to call the drones, honestly. These are the people who are totally checked out. They're sleepwalking through work. Now look, even us engaged people can have days where we feel tired, right? After the GA, if you will. But we're talking about on a constant basis, this is the kind of person who punches in, punches out, kind of more of like the factory floor kind of model. They are not necessarily going to go above and beyond. They're not real connected to the organization's mission. Now the thing that is important to note, and I gave you the punchline here because we couldn't do the animation with this PowerPoint, but 80% of employees are not engaged in their work. 80%. Does that shock anyone? Okay, not if that shocks you. That shocked the hell out of me, right? 8 out of 10 people are essentially going through their job and are just kind of like, you know, going through the motions, not necessarily having a kind of connection to it. So what does this mean in terms of the actual cost? All right, who knows where this is from? It's just Office Space, right? The 1999 movie with Peter and Lomberg and all that kind of stuff. Love this caricature of kind of the soul-crushing, you know, cube farm kind of reality, which is kind of the movement from an industrial age into an information age, if you will, of kind of work, right? So here is, if you can think of Peter as kind of that unengaged archetype, here is what it means in terms of numbers. We know that there are, according to salary.com, okay, who did a study about this a couple years ago, that 65% of people spend at least 3 hours of their week, and many a lot more, surfing the web and doing stuff that has nothing related to work. 46% of them are actually hunting for a new job while at work. 46% at any given time. And when you ask them why, they say, I'm bored. There's no incentive for me to do any kind of more work. And I hate my boss. Literally, those three things. Okay, so I want to share a story, actually, as it relates to Peter. So think of all the Peters, right, out there. This guy's not, he's not stupid. He's just, and he's not lazy. He's totally bored and unengaged, right? He's the definition of unengaged. So a couple years ago, I had the privilege of speaking with a guy named Jonah Peretti. Has anyone heard of Jonah Peretti? Okay. Jonah started a company, he's CEO and founder of BuzzFeed Media. Do people know BuzzFeed? Of course they do, right. Okay, so Jonah, he was like, golly, here is my business model. There is a network of people that is larger and more influential than any other network out there. It's totally stealth, and we're going to get their eyeballs, and I'm going to build a media empire. And I was like, Jonah, you're nuts. Okay. And he's saying, and he called it, these are the Bored at Work Network. BuzzFeed right now has a valuation of billions of dollars. It's in some ways eclipsed the valuation of a lot of traditional media companies. BuzzFeed is the one that has like top 10 lists for why Harry Potter is a feminist. You know, like those types of things, right? Right? Those kind of clickbait kind of things. Hundreds of millions of people click on that stuff, and they do it during work, and it's not just Cyber Monday when they shop, and they're totally disengaged. So when you talk about this in terms of economic costs, there are actually, we pin a cost of about $450 billion a year that is lost in productivity because of disengaged workers. $450 billion. So let's think about the projects that went over because somebody didn't feel like doing their job that day, right? Extension, extension, extension. Or somebody who didn't do it right the first time, so we had to correct, right? It's all those little things. When we look at a macro kind of labor market perspective, there's a huge cost for not having the kind of work environment that Judy was talking about and that Alyssa was mentioning and that certainly Scott and Mimi are going to talk about more, the kind of environment where people are empowered and trusted to do their best work. That's a great place to work. And I would argue that having a great place to work strategy, it's not a nice to have. It's a must to have. It's a must have. Okay, so what are we talking about here? And when Alyssa was talking about Mort Mandel, some of the changes that he made seemed very simple. They seemed also kind of soft, you know, like, oh, the bathrooms, make them nicer. Okay, we are people. We respond to those things. So let's keep that in mind. Robert Levering is a co-founder of the Great Place to Work Institute. They founded it about 25 years ago. They're the ones who come out with that top 100 best places to work list that Fortune publishes every year. Mimi, again, will talk more about that and kind of Google's role in that. And he basically says there are three key ingredients. Their entire algorithm and everything that they do is based on these three key ingredients and measuring them. One is, a great place to work is one where you trust the people you work with, take pride in the work that you do, and enjoy the people that you work with. Very much dovetails with our back of the envelope survey right here, right? Mission alignment, recognition, so that you take pride in some of the stuff that you do, in some of the work that you do. So I'm not going to get into the how, and I want to make sure that people know that from a great place to work perspective, becoming a great place to work is one part science and one part art, and very much customizable to different organizations. Every organization is different. I like to, when I was working in philanthropy, I always loved Jeff Solomon's quote of, you know one foundation, you know one foundation. Kind of the same thing. We are different type of entities in terms of organizations. But here's the value, here's the benefit of actually when you take a strategic approach to talent management, when you think about the people experience, how you give feedback, the physical environment, all of those things that go beyond some of the harder type of cells, we start to flip that paradigm of 80% disengaged and 20% engaged as such. So turnover becomes lower significantly. And I should say, these are year on year. It's not like you have to wait a decade. 40% lower in turnover because people are like, wait a minute, you're investing in me, maybe I'll invest in you as well. We have higher engagement of 38%. Now the 2x revenue, I want to make sure that we also temper this. A lot of the great place to work kinds of work has been done in the private sector and in business. There is really a dearth of knowledge out there about what really is the return on investment, if you will, in the nonprofit sector. And we know that the social sector is different than the private sector. So I want to own that. And that's honestly one of the things that we're working on and hopefully as part of a broader movement to be able to measure some of these better cultural kind of movements. So the 2x revenue, let's just say it's more about productivity. People are more productive. And that's the benefit of a great place to work. Now, we've all been in maybe these types of situations, or does this sound familiar, right? When, let's say it's a lean year, maybe you're at a deficit, maybe you want to show more of a surplus, who knows? Maybe there's a professional development line item, maybe you want to, there's some element where you can make a decision to invest more in people, or not. And it's usually the person who's minding the, you know, profit and loss, who is going to say, oh my God, if we invest in our people, you know, what happens if they leave? Right? And please God, have every CEO answer, well, what if we don't and they stay? This reminds me of a quote that I read from Method CEO. Is everyone, you know, Method, that like natural, like whatever. So the guy who founded it, he's really quirky. He's like a weird kind of guy. And he basically, this reminds me of something that he said, which is mediocre employees are like empty calories. They make you bigger, definitely not healthier. That's kind of like, in order to make the mediocre much more high performing, we have to invest in people. These are dynamic problems that we're working on in an adaptive kind of system and framework, and this is the way that we should be thinking about it. Now, tomorrow we are going to have the privilege of hearing from a personal hero of mine and somebody who's invested in people both in his business as well as for 30 years through the Wexner Foundation. And ultimately, what Les Wexner has shown us, what Mort Mandel has shown us, and others who understand, is that people are the most valuable asset of any organization. We work in organizations that deliver programs and services to the community. The more we can invest in these individuals to deliver better programs, better services, the better they will be. And that's really what we're talking about in terms of developing people. And so I'm using Les as a kind of transition into the Jewish. Where's the Jewish in all this? What's the business? What's the Jewish values case to be made for this? So in a conversation with one of my colleagues and mentors, Hal Lewis of Spertus Institute, he reminded me of a sugya in Talmud, a story in Talmud, that really speaks to the core place that we as a Jewish community can take in order to, and the real responsibility that we have to become great places to work. So the story goes something like this. People die, a person dies and goes up to heaven. And they reach the gates of heaven and they're asked a series of questions. And the first question that they ask has nothing to do with their religious observance. It has nothing to do with their charitable level or activity. It has to do with this. Were you honest in your business dealings? Now that was very, I had not known this before, so I thank Hal for sharing that with me. And it really spoke to me in saying that the word avodah in Hebrew means work, but it also means divine service and worship. And in some cases, the argument could be made that in Judaism, we can see that becoming a great place to work is almost an act of godliness. And one where we are going to be judged, if you will, on the day-to-day dealings that we have in an environment. So we at Leading Edge, the Jewish Leadership Pipelines Alliance, are very concerned with this, probably obsessively so, honestly. And one of the things that we're going to be launching very, very soon is what we're calling a Leading Places to Work initiative. What we're hoping to do is cultivate a group and a real culture of practice around organizations that value people and that really want to make investments in culture in order to become better places to work. So as a first step to this, in this winter, we're going to be launching an employee assessment that is really going to help organizations measure engagement within their organizations. Are you part of that 80-20? And hopefully it's 80 engaged and 20 disengaged. And then there's the so what. All right, so what can you do in order to become a better place to work? If anyone has any questions about that, I'd be thrilled to answer and engage in conversation about that. And now this is the easy stuff, the why. I'm going to move it on to Mimi, who's going to talk about the how. How do organizations take the steps to become great places to work? There you go.
Hi, it's so great to be here today at the General Assembly. My name is Mimi Kravitz. I'm the Chief Talent Officer of Hillel International, and I've been in this role for about 3 months now. I actually started my career right after school, right after college in the Jewish world, where I spent 3 years at the Hillel at Stanford doing work to engage students. Woohoo! And then I went on a journey in the business world. So I've been away for about 11 years. The last three of which, I've been a marketing executive at Google doing what we called employment branding. It was my job to tell the story of work at Google in a way that would help us find, grow, and keep the very best talent on the planet. And so, a lot of the ideas that I'm going to share with you today, I wanted to let you know, are in this book by Laszlo Bock, who's the head of People Ops, what we call HR at Google. I've taken some of his ideas, some of my experience from Google, and some of what I think would be most relevant to us in the Jewish world and thinking about how we can create great places to work and pull them together. So I wanted to let you know that as great as a case as Gali made for why to become a great place to work, it's actually not a question that anybody at Google was ever asked to build a case about. So nobody ever said, by doing A, you're going to get B in the bottom line for Google. In fact, the why question that we used to ask all the time was, why aren't there more people at our backs? Why doesn't everybody see that if you want the best products or the best outcomes, you need the very best people? And if you want the very best people, there is no other way but to create a great environment for them to work in, to create a place that they want to come every day and work. That was our why question. So I had to make sure to get this out of the way. I know when you hear about Google as a great place to work, what comes to mind? You think, of course, there's lots of free food, there are slides and bouncy balls to sit on. Of course, everybody there is happy. Okay, and I'm not going to tell you that that's not true. In my 6 years at Google, I sat at 15 different desks. We used to move around all the time. That's why nobody printed anything or had any sort of filing cabinet. And my very favorite of which was a desk where I sat with three other people. We were all very crammed in, right outside of what we called POPS Park. So POPS is an acronym for People Operations, our HR department. And this was a big playground in the middle of our floor. And you would sometimes have meetings at a picnic table under a slide. It was awesome. It made me very popular with my two preschool-age kids when they came to visit me at work. But after looking at a whole ton of data on what makes people happy to work at Google, it turns out things like that have nothing to do with it. Now, they're very cool, and we love them, and we think it helps make people more creative. But it turns out that the things that have to do that make Google a great place to work are mostly free. And much of what you need, we've got it in this room, in all the work that you're doing. And that is, and what that means is we don't need to fundamentally change anything about who we are to become great places to work, but we may have to rethink some things about our workplace cultures and about how we operate. So I'm going to go through 7 principles. I had a ton I wanted to select from, so these are just a few that make Google a great place to work that we can learn from. And the first, so I used to be part of a group of people that gave what we called our culture talk to the swarms of executives who come through the Googleplex every week. And they come wanting to make their ads work better and to make more money, but they also come trying to soak up a little bit of whatever it is Google has that makes it kind of keep winning these awards and attracting all these great people. And I always started here on the point about mission. Because it doesn't really matter what business they were in. Every person in every industry wants to wake up every day and do work that matters. And so the reason you need an excellent mission is because you need to be able to help employees understand why their work matters. This point is exactly why every CEO in Silicon Valley will try and convince you that their radical new technology that you can't even understand because it's so deep in the back end of your computer is being created in equal parts to make money and to save the world. It's a joke, right? If you see the show Silicon Valley, there's this great scene where Ehrlich, doesn't matter, you don't need to know who these guys are for this to be funny, where he goes into this drug-induced hallucination to come up with a new name for this company, Pied Piper, and he just ends up standing there and chanting, change the world, make the world a better place, make the world a better place, right? They're all trying to make the world a better place. Good news for us, that's what we're trying to do, right? But it matters how you do this mission thing. So first, you can't just have this lofty aspiration that nobody can figure out how you're going to get there. You need a way that you're going to get there. At Google, we were going to organize, from the time that Larry and Sergey, these are the co-founders of Google, were sitting in a garage starting this company, they had this audacious goal to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. Wow, that is specific. You can get behind that mission. Then you have to share it broadly. This mission is a mantra that every Googler and every visitor can tell you, and you need to make sure your work aligns behind it. Because if you're doing lots of different stuff that lots of people want, and it doesn't line up to your mission, anyone can smell that out. Your work needs to be aligned behind your mission. And lastly, and this one is critical for being a great place to work, you need to help every single person translate what their day job is into that mission. So this was part of the responsibility of my team at Google, and we spent a lot of time helping these young college grads try and figure out how their work that was answering emails from distraught AdWords users, why that had anything to do with this. And you know what? It has a ton to do with it. Because not only are you making businesses successful, helping them earn money, advance their mission, and change their lives, but also you're getting more business information online to make information universally accessible and useful. Okay, another point. At Google, so this slide kind of formatted funny, but we aimed for near 100% internal transparency. Now, there are about 75,000 employees working at Google right now. I'm sure that sounds incredibly scary, but actually, Googlers know months before anybody else what product is going to launch, and they don't say anything. So as it turns out, it's much easier to share everything with everyone than it is to sit around trying to figure out how to maintain secrets and who to tell what. And not only that, it has amazing benefits because when you give smart people more information, they're going to make better decisions. If they know what's going on with your finances, they can decide where to invest in good ways. And if they know what their colleagues are doing, they can start the right collaborations that'll get better work done. And not only that, but telling everybody who works for you everything has an even better spillover effect that it preserves secrecy. Because when you set the bar high and you expect people to meet it, they usually do. Now, the one thing I'll tell you, because people always ask this question, is, but what if? And the answer is, we did fire people on the spot when they leaked something. Because this is such an important value at Google that we knew if we let it go, we were dead and we wouldn't let go of it. One of the best examples of this is this image you're looking at is a company meeting called TGIF, where Larry and Sergey, the founders of Google, every single week, have a company-wide meeting where they share the upcoming product launches, their thoughts on whatever the current crisis is that we are going through, and even at Google, we have crises all the time. You can read them in the news. And then they take any question from any Googler on anything they want to ask. That's radical. That kind of transparency leads to a sort of trust and loyalty that it's very hard to buy with any kind of other investment or money. Okay, so if you're going to tell everyone everything, you need to offer them the opportunity to provide feedback. They need a say. And we have a lot of ways that Googlers can provide feedback, the most important of which is a survey called Googlegeist, which is an employee survey, the sort of thing Gali was talking about. And it has incredibly high participation for a few reasons. One, the results are shared transparently. That seems to be a theme here, right? So anybody can go online and cut by SVP how happy or sad, productive or unproductive any department is at Google and use that to make decisions on where they're going to go, which you better bet makes those SVPs want their scores to be the best. Another reason is because we immediately set up committees to try and to act on the results of the survey, right? Because the only thing you can do worse than not asking people for their opinion is asking them for it and not listening. So these are reasons I think it works. By the way, I was super excited to find out that Gali was running this survey and through Leading Edge, and excited to get Hillel International in on the pilot round later this year. So definitely talk to her if that interests you for your organization, so as long as you have the resources to follow up. Okay, next point. In 2009, a bunch of Googlers decided to do a study on whether managers matter. The reason was there was this great internal debate about whether such incredibly smart engineers really needed managers, or couldn't they just figure it out themselves? And the answer is, managers matter a lot. A lot. They actually matter more than any other investment you can make in professional development or benefits, and they matter not only on whether employees are happy, but on whether they're successful. So the results when we crossed all this data were that good managers led not only to happier, longer retained employees, but also to better products. And so what did we do in response to this? So the exciting part about the survey is not the shockingly boring things that you're looking at in front of you, which is what makes a great manager, because most of you might have guessed these things, but that we decided as a result of this to put in place a manager training that any new manager has to take within their first 3 months. And it's not because you can teach management in a classroom. You can tell people about management in a classroom, but they're going to have to learn on the job. But because marking that transition from being an individual contributor to being somebody else's supervisor is such an important moment that you have to pause and mark. And the other thing we did is we added this to the criteria that people are evaluated on for promotion. Because if you're going to grade somebody on it, then they know it counts. And we knew this is an important part of our leadership. Okay, three more points, and I'll be a little quicker. So if you're hiring people well and doing a good job managing them, setting clear expectations, then the most important thing you can do as a manager is get the heck out of the way. Good, smart people, given the right end outcomes, want to figure it out themselves. Right? You guys know that. Anybody who's worked knows that. And so we're radical about this at Google. We actually give everybody a percentage of their time, what we call 20% time, to do whatever they want within the larger, it used to be within the larger company mission. Now we prefer to people to focus on the larger mission of their department. But because we trust that smart people are going to be more successful working on things they care about. But you don't need to give people free time. I understand you don't have a lot of it in order to give them freedom. You just need to help point them in the right direction, and then trust that if the way they get there is different than the way you would have gotten there, the fact that they're bought in on it and they've thought it through themselves might lead to an even better outcome. Okay, this point goes well with the theme of this conference because it's about innovation. So one of the reasons that we think Google has continued to be successful in competing with startups and Facebook and everyone else in the Valley is because of the true, incredible opportunity for innovation. And this is a talent point because talented people want to be challenged and they want to think big. And so Google doesn't just allow innovation, we force it, right? When you go into a meeting and you present your newest idea, most likely the question you're going to get asked, no matter how great it is, what you've brought forward, is that all? Could we do more? But that little piece we did already, is there something we could do that's even bigger? And that is exciting for anybody, to be pushed to think in that kind of big way, and it comes right through from Larry and Sergey because they truly believe that to solve society's biggest problems, and certainly to solve our community's biggest problems, we're going to need to do things in big new ways all the time. We need to always be asking what more we could do. And so, you know, as a term that we used for this at Google that I love is uncomfortably excited, right? Good people want to come to work every day and be uncomfortably excited. You want a challenge that you're so thrilled about, and it's just a little beyond your reach, so you always have the chance to be learning. Okay, last point is to never miss an opportunity to say thank you. So one of the things that I've been so, that's made me chuckle as I've talked to people about management and I do these culture sessions is people say, gosh, these millennials, they keep wanting to be recognized. You know, like it's a problem with them, right? I got news for you. Everybody wants to be recognized, right? Everyone wants that, don't you? Whether it's the leader of your lay board or the CEO of your organization or your administrator or your fundraiser, they're going to do their job just a little better than they otherwise would have and come to work with just a little more energy to make your workplace great and to succeed in your goals if you stop and catch them doing something right and say thank you. So thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. And I want to pass off to Scott Kaufman to talk about his federation as a model of a great place to work.
Great, thanks. Oh, I have to do this. This is a... All right, so I have two disclaimers. One, as I listen to our prior two speakers, it's pretty clear to me that I'm here for gender equity. Secondly, I just got back from Israel yesterday afternoon and then went to Detroit for an event and came here. So if at some point I fall asleep, just wake me up. Okay, so when you talk about what makes a work environment successful, there are two issues. There's culture and there's talent. And those are the two drivers of almost every success. And in my life in the nonprofit space, both as working there and for many years as a lay leader, we spent inordinate amounts of time around strategy. Strategic plans for this, strategic plans for that, committee, subcommittee, another committee. And invariably, a lot of them would sort of sit on a shelf because new leadership, a new board chair, a new campaign would come in and not like it, or we're afraid to take risk, or we're going to upset a big donor. And the reality is, if you have the right culture, and we'll talk about what the right culture is, and the right talent, it doesn't matter what the strategy is, because the smart people will figure it out, and they'll have a culture where they can move the needle. So what's winning culture? Start with the premise, and we talk about this a lot, and I think we live it, is around the phrase, Jewish is a team sport. Winning cultures have teams. People are empowered. They feel appreciated. In the big change, and I think the internet's been a driver of this because of the ability to get information, in the 20th century, corporations, and we saw it in Detroit with the meltdown of the auto industry, Jewish organizations, synagogues, JCCs, federations, were really structured vertically along a command and control model. That was sort of the default model of corporate America and the nonprofit sector. The good companies and organizations in the 21st century have done what I call the C change, the letter C, command and control to connect and collaborate. So that kind of is the worldview of how you build. It speaks to a flatter organization. So, you know, one last point on this. Why are we up here? You know, how are we doing? Because I think there has to be some level of credibility. So the things federations normally measure, what's your campaign? Is your endowment growing? We're doing real well in Detroit. We're moving the needle every year, particularly in endowment in the last couple of years, significantly. The things they don't always measure, how engaged are people? How many new people are coming to the table? How many donors do you have? Which I think speaks to, do people like and trust you? We're in our fifth year in a row growing that number. So I think, you know, I sort of because you can't go look online and we're not Google, you can't see what our market cap is. You know, I wanted to sort of give that. So talent is the other piece. A winning culture can get you good, but if you don't have great talent, you can't be awesome. And the inverse is true. If you have really talented people in a bad culture, they can do okay. You get both, and unfortunately it's a bad slide because the Tigers didn't do so well this year, but it was a hopeful slide. So when you talk about talent, one, it starts with the recruiting, and I'm trying to use some real-life examples. There was that one slide that just struck me about the what if they leave. I actually had that conversation. I was hiring a lot of people from outside the field, not all the people, because we're about a 50% mix for key jobs from career Jewish communal professionals and complete outsiders. And they were saying, one of my colleagues said, well, aren't you going to invest in them and they're going to leave? I said, yeah, they probably are going to leave. Maybe 3 years, but they're going to leave us way better than they found us, and we'll get other people. And maybe they'll leap to big jobs, and that's what's been happening. People are leaving at some point for major steps up, which is the best recruiting tool you can have is to point to where the person is now in charge of something big. So, don't settle in recruiting. It's important. We've had key jobs open 6 months, 9 months, in one case over a year, because you got to not only have to be talented, they have to fit the culture. And you have to be willing to hire and fire around that culture. So one of the things we looked at recently is the idea of investing in talent. And look, as I said, all these things are going up. Two other things that are going up that do cost money. So it's not all about money, and it isn't. But our payroll's gone up, and our headcount has gone up. And there is some level of correlation between that and our successes. We normally had a sort of talent budget for professional development, which would be like going to the GA or going to a conference specific to your thing. And that's what we did. And this year we said that's not enough. So we took $50,000 and it was our board. They didn't intuitively get it right away, but we pushed on them to create sort of a curriculum. We surveyed all the employees. What would you like to learn that would make you better at your job? And that's where it came from. And every person on the team was participating. And $50,000 isn't a lot, but it's not nothing. And I think it's a statement. And we're going to test this year. We have a curriculum built. And we'll see where it goes. And if it works, I would hope to be able to grow that. Part of the surveying, though, also speaks to your employees as customers, that it matters what they think. And many of the good ideas come from there. So one of the things that comes up over and over again is this idea of accessibility. Really important. You have to have, I do it, our key managers do it. Nobody's afraid to come in and talk to us about anything and complain, even to a point where sometimes I wish they weren't so willing to come in, but they are. And I think if you're going to err on one side or the other, that's the side to err on. Because, there are things you just miss because you're focused on something in leadership and in management. But they don't miss it. The team's not going to miss it. Everyone's not going to miss it. Is there any bottles of water or anything? I'm having sort of jet lag, really dry mouth syndrome going here. If anyone could volunteer to bring me some water, that would be really awesome. Our teams are always sitting down and evaluating things. After, before, what's the follow-through plan? And just this communication. No one's afraid. No one sits around at our federation thinking about, I better do this to please my boss. It's all about the customer. And I've seen it over and over again. There is a culture now, and it wasn't there before, of willingness to sort of truth to power. That's absolutely critical for a successful organization. And you just have to sit down and do it. You just have to have meetings and create an environment where your door is open. So transparency was another thing that came up. The reality is everyone's going to find out everything anyway in today's world. That's the default, and that's one of the things why the command and control doesn't work, because you can't control anything. I find particularly our millennial employees, our younger employees, have very highly tuned what I call bullshit sensors. They pick it up real fast. Because maybe they're raised on sarcastic television or something, but you can't fool them. Sometimes our older donors you can say things to and they'll buy it, but it doesn't work, and it's not going to work going forward. So when we're doing something potentially controversial, closing a JCC, taking a position on Iran, or even something that affects them directly, like creating a new compensation policy for bonuses, we have those conversations. We have them before the public knows, just like at Google. And if sometimes if we don't, we immediately have it thereafter and have a very open, and we talk about the why behind them, not just the what. The why is critical, so they're in on, even if they may not agree, at least people understand why did they do that. So teamwork. Incredibly important. Who went to the University of Michigan? There's always a lot of hands when you're at a Jewish event when you ask that question. Bo Schembechler talked about the team, the team, the team. In that, you know, that speaks to a lot of what good organizations do. We're always doing team kind of activities, contests, outings, things. It's really in the culture at our federation. Team success newsletters from each department and contests and you know, it's part of a team is you share the wins. We're very big on not, you know, it wasn't, the fundraising success wasn't me, it wasn't this person or that person. It's a collective, and you have, the other thing is you have to share the losses, too, because people have to be vested, and that's important. Teams, you win as a team, you lose as a team. The other thing you have to share, and this is, I don't know if this came out in any of the data, baked goods. Jewish Federation, I had a new employee tell me there's like this thing in Jewish organizations that you gain 15 pounds the first 6 months you start there. Apparently it's true, but there's always, I was just in Israel this week and the emails of what baked good is where at Federation were coming and there was this one Milky Way cake and I was really upset that I was not there. So speed. To me, speed is the new black of Federation life. It's, you know, when you think about the generational relationship to speed, when I was a kid and I was home from school one day, there were like three shows you could watch, and they were all pretty bad, and you were trapped. And actually, there were a couple good ones on the Canadian channel that you get in Detroit, but that was it. And if you wanted to know who won the game after you went to bed, you waited for the newspaper the next day. Now kids get instant access. There's 8 million things they can watch in real time. They get the score updates in real time on their phone. So their notion of speed is radically different. And if by nature of sort of a defensive posture, often in the nonprofit sector, fear of pissing off or upsetting, that makes us slow. And we did have a generation, and we still do, and you can't alienate your older generation who may like lots of meetings and things, but if you're not fast, the lay and professional talent, but particularly professional talent, they're going to go somewhere else because there are fast options now. So that is the thing. I can't say we've perfected it, but we did a couple things. One, we eliminated on the lay side, we eliminated one whole layer of governance last year. So a lot of meetings went away, which is, you know, the meetings are sort of the bane of existence. And on the professional side, we did a complete top-to-bottom reorg. One of the problems we were seeing is that we were excellent in silos. It wasn't cross-platform enough. We tore the whole thing down, reorged it. I don't know, 4 or 5 months it was done. And it's working. And it's not working perfect, and there's going to be a lumpy learning curve. But my guess is 6-7 years ago that would have taken a year or two and probably not have happened. So that you got to, you know, I think our sector really has to start thinking about being faster. Don't have all the answers on that, but I know will be one of the giant issues. So this is a very important one. Startup. You know, the trip I just was on, I took 20 CEOs of major Michigan companies to Israel, and we studied the startup nation, looking at the entrepreneurial ecosystem of Israel and how can we import that to Michigan, which is sort of a risk-averse corporate state. And so, you know, I just spent the last 10 days sitting with the founders of Mobileye and Our Crowd and the chief scientists and all these social sector startups. And what was very clear, particularly in the VCs, Jerusalem Venture Partners and people like that, that the value add of the good VCs was much more than the money. There was a strategic add. So that's very important, particularly as a federation, because you have all these things you fund. and you should be adding value, your organization, to them and creating that culture. And when you talk about teamwork, that piece is very important. I think we've built a very strong relationship with our agencies. Also, you need that open kind of, they can feel comfortable and not fear of losing the money by voicing. That, I think the culture extends when you're an umbrella type organization. It has to extend outside your format. The other thing, when we were talking to all the startup people, they clearly had this connect and collaborative model, and they also almost all failed. Actually, I take that back. They all failed at something before they had their big success. So that issue, fear of failure, I think is worse in the not-for-profit sector because this fear that we're going to upset and lose. And the reality is, if you talk honestly to most people, not all, they're not going to abandon you over one decision. Some will, and that's the cost of doing business. But we have to be less afraid, and that's an important piece of the startup. I'll give you one quick example that we're going to drill down tomorrow. We're having a panel on the Detroit Next Gen. So we had an issue in Detroit. It was a total exodus community. All the young people were leaving. One of my colleagues said to me when I took the job, your job is going to be to sort of sunset the community as it once great Jewish community will no longer exist in a generation. And the demographic trend line said that would be true. We said, no, we're going to not accept that, and we're going to go all in on this attraction, retention, engagement of young people. So the way we started it was that we created a startup. We hired a team, put them in the basement. They had ping pong tables and all that stuff. They had a budget, one mission, attract and retain, engage young people. They had no committee, and they reported just to me. And that worked for 2 years. They went really fast. At some point, we've had to buy back the company and reintegrate it into the Federation. That will be tomorrow's story if you want to come. Sort of. That was pure startup, and it would not have worked using the conventional model. I'm certain of that. One thing I find is the people, when they feel like they're doing something awesome, they love it. And that speaks to, I think, that study. If it's not an invitation, the designers, if it's not something someone's going to put on the fridge, if it's not an event someone's going to immediately post on Facebook while they're at the event, we're not doing good enough. So whether it's we hand-delivered something a couple weeks ago, our women's philanthropy, an invitation, it was an apple, and it had a reason for being an apple that tied into the speaker, and you wouldn't understand it until you went. But that, and people were, in a sense, the phrase I like is surprise and delight your customers, surprise and delight your employees. But it becomes kind of a mission when you're doing something awesome. And that there's some more examples for that, but I feel like we're going too slow, so I'm going to go through that. As part of that, though, you have to measure stuff. And the stuff you measure, you will do a better job in succeeding. It's an important part of creating that culture. You have to have goals, and you have to measure them, and then you have to understand when you miss them, sort of the deep dive on the why. Fun. I remember once as a kid telling my dad I didn't really like my job or love my job. It wasn't fun. And he looked at me. He's a kid who grew up kind of poor and took his family, to a successful place. And for his generation, that wasn't a thing. Is work fun? Work is work. Fun's what you do outside of work. That's not the case anymore. And particularly I see with our younger employees, the social overlay to the work life. It's very tied together. And you got to make it fun. Not every minute of every day can be fun, but there has to be. I mean, the slides, we don't have slides, but we have sarcasm, and that's fun. We have, just the other day, we had Michigan State Week. Everyone wore their outfits, and once again, baked goods, themed baked goods. I got a little carried away this year. It's probably my fault. I shouldn't have pushed for live ammo and should have stuck with the rubber bullets. But anyway, we lost again, so that was... you got to put that in, and it has to really... It can't just be the one day, the costume party once a year. It has to be kind of in the DNA. Talked about that mission. So when we talk about talent and culture, passion is essential to both. I mean, we're unique. This is our great advantage to almost all other places to work, is that we're doing, we take care of the needs of the Jewish people. We're building a vibrant Jewish future. We're you know, it's without us, and I believe this, the Jewish world would be a lot worse off. And that's powerful. And if somebody cares about that, if they want to, you know, grow Jewish philanthropy, strengthen Jewish identity, build Jewish community, we're a great place to do that. And that's a huge advantage, because not everyone wants to do that, but for those who do, we are the place to work. And you have to keep that in your conversation. You know, you can't get so buried in the day-to-day. And that's a challenge, and it's always a challenge. And the way you do that is by recognizing and appreciating and putting that into the culture, and take the time to send the email to the team the night after a successful thing. Our department heads are much better at that. In some ways, I was thinking maybe as I was watching the slides, I don't do that enough. But, you know, so that's... So we had a process as part of the reorg. We took, and this is the last one, we took every group in the building to talk about what are the values that you want to build this company around. And it took about a week. We had long, long discussions and meetings. I mean, it was all done in a week, but it ate up the better part of the week. And then each department had someone go to, you know, bring their list to a meeting where we all got together. And we started with like 156 things on the board, and we grouped them, and it came down to 8 of them. And these are things, as I said before, you'd hire and fire around. And you have to live them. I mean, it was things like integrity and teamwork and community-minded. But the last one, and I think the most important one to creating a culture, is be a mensch. And there isn't a week that goes by where that doesn't, you know, in my head, affect a decision. We had this group of very important major corporate CEOs, mostly non-Jewish, and we were running, it's the last day of the mission. We were up in Nazareth. We were running late, horrible traffic, it was terrible weather, and we had one more thing to go to, and it was this Arab-owned tech company, and everybody, you know, it was a packing issue. We didn't leave time for shopping. We were going to be way late and then miss the, you know, cram the packing and the shopping. And this was a company, you know, we don't fund them. We don't really know them. And we sort of said, we can't not go. They're expecting us. We have to go. The group understood it and went. And it was an incredibly powerful experience. But that has to underpin everything. And, you know, I think we hire mensches. We've fired people who were very good at their job but not mensches. And you have to be willing to do that. It might set the organization back in the near term, and we've done that. But that, to me, is so critical, once again, because we're not making widgets. We're changing lives, and that's important. So I'm going to stop now.
Thanks, Linda. We know the importance that we've heard, and you know, clearly discussed today, the importance of investing in professional development. We also hear and know that the demands, and those of us who live and work it, that the demands of working in a Jewish communal environment are significant, and we're stretched, and we're understaffed and overworked, and all of those things that we have. And so there's this constant push-pull between how do you take the time and the dollars to make this a priority. And there are some organizations that do it very well and others not quite as well. My question for you is, do you have recommendations to how we elevate this as a communal priority for our organization?
You want to? That's sort of your mission. Mm-hmm.
That's right. So I will say that having sessions like these at the Jewish Federation of North America General Assembly Conference is absolutely one of the ways that we do that. Their Leading Edge came together, the Jewish Leadership Pipelines Alliance came together because 15 foundations, Jewish foundations and federations came together and said, we need to do better in terms of investing in talent, in terms of developing the leadership pipeline. We are in a position where we're able to bend the trajectory. And this is exactly one of the fora that we need to start talking about the why, start talking about the how, and the real value of investing in people. Because as Scott and as Mimi have said, and as we all know, we are in the business, if you will, of programs and services, and really making the world a better place. We are the ones who do that, meaning it's the individuals. And really investing in the individuals. And there are some things that are tangible, and there are some things that are intangible. And a lot of times, it's about showing appreciation, and not necessarily that salary bump is absolutely one of those things that are critical. I will say that I took off a slide because we tried to cram way too much into this, but there is every year, nonprofit HR does a nonprofit practices, management practices kind of survey. And they try to understand why is it that there's turnover, basically, in organizations. And in 2014, by the way, the 2015 survey is open, so I encourage all of you to go and actually feed some of the data, because the more data we know, the better we'll understand what trends are. So in 2014, there was an average of a 20% turnover rate in the nonprofit sector, and that's for all levels, essentially, of nonprofits. And when you ask the people why they left, they mentioned three reasons. One is salary. Okay, they weren't paid enough. Two is they didn't see any kind of growth trajectory opportunity for them. So they had to go out and up, if you will, and that's something that we know in smaller organizations is very common. And the third was burnout. Now, the interesting thing about that salary piece is that half of the people who actually said that they left their organization, so that 20% turnover, they went to another nonprofit. So it wasn't like they were looking for like JPMorgan Chase money, you know? it was much more around elevating some of the issues that we were talking about, some of those, you know, softer things that show people that, yes, actually, we are doing holy work and therefore need to be trusted and trusted to do our best work.
Great. Questions from the audience? Yes. If you don't mind, would you come to the microphone? Because we're recording in this way. We'll...
Sorry.
Thank you.
Hello. So I have kind of an inverse question for you guys. Any insights you can offer would be appreciated. So I'm an exec at an intermediate federation. Got a millennial. It's working great. I have another employee, my same age, not quite millennial. But do you guys have any insights on how to motivate and create a great workplace for someone who is of retirement age when the rest of the workforce is not retirement age? So, who's not interested in retiring? This is just kind of God's work.
The generational challenge. Yeah. One of the reasons we had to buy back the company when we created the next gen model was that reason, that it was creating a disconnect in two cultures. You can't have two cultures. So we physically moved the next gen department into the most veteran space in the building, our development team, very senior group. And there were two reasons. I wanted the senior people to get energized by the young people and this idea of mentoring and this fun, high energy kind of to rub off. And what I needed the young people to do is the commitment to the mission, that it's more than parties and they needed, and the whole how you relate to the donor, all the things that they knew, wanted them to impart to this young group. And it's work. They sort of bonded because they're hanging out together. They're in the same space. So the physical, it was one of the slides talked about the physical space. That matters. We tore down some walls physically. But putting them together, I think, was the key to that, because there was this sort of weird resentment in both directions when one was in the basement and one was upstairs, and it just, they didn't understand. It changed a lot. I think it really worked. So just getting them together physically was essential to that.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, please. We'll repeat the question, just say it. Okay, how's it?
Can you point to any one or two factors culture?
So the question is, to repeat, if the panel can point to one or two factors for federations specifically that would elevate the place, the culture, or the place to work. Is that correct?
You want to take this?
One clearly is the overhead issue. That people who are successful in their business life often check their business acumen at the door when they become a donor. Not always, and I'm seeing more that aren't, particularly among young self-made entrepreneur types who understand that talent is not a commodity. That has to be talked about a lot. That's why Leading Edge, in my opinion, one of the things it's going to do is the major foundations change the narrative, and some of the biggest donors to the federation system are those foundations. I think that will trickle down into the system. I hope it will trickle down into the system. So that conversation, you know, because, oh, your budget went up and now it's 12% instead of 9%. If you can increase your impact by a factor beyond a multiplier of the cost, incremental cost increase, what other business wouldn't do that? And that type of thinking, we have to keep pushing, because for many years, it was even how they rated them, the Guide Stars and Charity Navigators. You know, look, it's other people's money. We have to be smart about it and resourceful and get the most out of each dollar. However, that doesn't mean that you know, we have to sort of design to a percentage of overhead. It's a terrible way to run a business, because what gets cut is marketing, training, the things that don't show value immediately. And any company that's only looking at their daily stock ticker or even their quarterly earnings, those are the worst companies. We need to be thinking 5 and 10 years out, and we need to spend money on things like R&D. It's a foreign concept to the nonprofit sector. All other companies have it. Why shouldn't we have R&D to try things? So that conversation has to change, and I think it's incumbent at a place like this, as we have lay leaders, professional leaders who are influential in the community, if they buy what we're saying, they got to spread that message, because we can't only do it. We need lay partners to change the narrative, because they're, in a sense, a third-party endorser.
I will tell you, from the landscape of the federation system, one of the things that we've seen is to provide people with opportunities different from their day-to-day routine. We tend to pigeonhole people, and silos are a huge problem in our organizations. To give people an opportunity to stretch themselves by working on something different, to partner them. I know that Google does this and other companies in terms of creating work groups, which, you know, move around. We tend to, you know, this is your job and this is your only job, but creativity inspires people to feel valued and to have an opportunity to try something different, and it's not a typical federation model, and those who have done it have had great success with it. Debbie.
Mimi, I was really fascinated by what you said. I'm so curious, actually, I mean, Scott, you've done an amazing job at this. Great. Going from Google to Hello, how are you going to, you know, translate the coolness of working at a Google into the Hello world, and what can you learn in the federation world from some of your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So the work I did at Google on employment branding, interestingly, when I walked into this role, because I only did it for about 3.5 years, Google already had a great employment brand around those, like, cool factors. The problem was those weren't the things that actually mattered to the employees we wanted. So as it turned out, like, great engineers aren't really looking for free food. They're looking to know. It sounds crazy, but I'm going to just, right? They're not, the free food wasn't selling them. When our recruiter said that on the phone, you know.
Scooters.
You know, for them, they wanted to know, will my work have an impact? You know, is the coding that I'm going to do actually going to make it into the code base? And am I going to be able to see somebody, like, on the bus next to me, you know, using that? And so we did a bunch of, anyway, we realized that, like, something wasn't clicking about our employment brand. We went and talked to our best employees. This is the part that you can learn from, right? We talked to the best. So not people who were complaining or whatever. We went to talk to people who were succeeding. And we tried to figure out what was inspiring them to do the work that they were doing. And we used that to build a new narrative. And the new narrative that we developed, and it's actually being, you know, revamped again, but we've been using for the last 3 years, is a slogan called, that we do cool things that matter. What we realized is that the engineers that we wanted to do really interesting, important work that had an impact on the world. And so based on that insight from talking to our best employees, we came up with this whole campaign, we built a bunch of case studies, and we used that as a premise of all the work that we were doing. And to accomplish a lot of goals, you know, whether it was helping each individual employee understand how their work added up, or helping figure out how to get more diverse pipelines to go into engineering work, which is one of the things we were thinking about. And I think that there's a parallel for what, you know, we need to do at Hillel, and probably what you need to do in the Federation world, which is like, who's successful and what are they doing here, and how can we build a narrative around that that'll get more great people to come in.
I should mention, actually, that Leading Edge, we are very, very, very interested in finding those bright spots. So who are, and there are so many rock stars in our right. solar system, right? So who are the ones who are just getting it done? And I've had many, many meetings with individuals working with very different organizations and ask them, who is the one person in your organization who just gets stuff done? You know, who just makes the magic happen in whatever way that you actually define it. Mm-hmm. But people know. People know who those bright spots are. And so just like Mimi said, it's really thinking about, well, what is it about you? And it's that kind of classic kind of, you know, what's working, appreciative inquiry kind of approach.
Yeah. Todd, and then I know you're waiting, so just give me one second.
So
go ahead.
At Google, you have teams that are allowed to do what they need to present a product. Yeah. God, it sounds like you had this young team get things isolated, had permission from your leadership to isolate them and do what they need. Rare, I think, in the Federation world. Most of the time, we are burdened by process, process, process. We process things to death. And I think the death knell to the millennial processing things to death.
There's a lot of nodding in the room.
Yeah. I'm just saying.
Exactly. And so to change the system and make a satisfactory workplace, better workplace for the younger worker, and I even think an older worker, mm-hmm. is to change a system that has been mired in bureaucracy, because we are living in a world that needs to change much more rapidly. Now, it's not only Google, it's the whole system needs to respond much more rapidly. So are you now able to do that because the model you set with the younger people through the rest of your federation? If so, how are you doing that? Has that model penetrated the rest of the system? Because I think that would lead to a much more satisfactory total workplace by being able to move more rapidly to meet your marketplace.
Right. So that portion of the business, it worked, and now we are moving it out to all the other parts. That was really what drove the reorg more than anything. And the answer is sort of. We're getting it, but it's not there yet. And we're getting decent buy-in. You know, I happen to have a president of my federation, president of the foundation, who are both running operating businesses. So they're not micromanagers. And B, because they're running an operating business, we're on a pretty large scale, and they're dealing with technology disruption and you know, their businesses are changing, you know, the death of the middleman. The lessons of the private sector, it's the same. I mean, this whole thing. So we're doing it. I'm seeing, you know, that's the challenge, though. And I think that's why we have to be brave enough to do it. And, you know, if they get rid of me for doing too much of it, you know, well, that'll be, I'll find another job.
And someone else will find it.
Right, but yeah. If we don't do that, we're just going to become irrelevant, but slowly. It's an existential issue. You've hit the nail on the head. And it doesn't mean there isn't role for key volunteers. There absolutely is. And they're, in a sense, this unbelievably talented free labor force that we have to leverage strategically. And they can add enormous value, and they do every day. But it can't be the old way of committee and meeting. It just takes too long. And look at great companies. They're fast. That's why the speed thing, to me, is the key to the whole thing. If we can figure out how to be fast. And people love winning. So if you start winning with this, then the resistance goes away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Everyone's a fan then.
I'm sorry.
Can I add this? I just want to add something. So Google has this problem too, right? There's 75,000 employees, and people build bureaucracy for reasons, right? Because they're trying to orchestrate people. Like any system that's in place, it's there for a reason. So just a silly idea. So we had this thing called bureaucracy busters that happen every year, where people basically submitted the bureaucratic practices that they were most pissed off about, and we picked a few that we were going to actually try and do something about, because you're not going to knock them all out of the way. So if there's like some budgeting tool that's driving everybody nuts, so you take a couple of people and you say, okay, we're going to get rid of that, but the problem is we still, you know, so for you, you still need to tell donors where you are in their budget. You still need to report on metrics. So tell us the quicker way of doing that and let people try and come up with the solutions to get rid of that stuff. I don't know. You're not going to change it all overnight, but I think that, you know, especially when you're saying millennials like don't want that, to see efforts moving in the right direction and the recognition that it's a problem, I think goes a long way in inspiring people.
So we're coming to the end of time. So, I'm going to let you ask your question because you've been standing there waiting. But so I just want to say, we have just a couple of minutes. We're going to multitask at this moment as you're asking your question. I think that, you know, one of the ways that we make these sessions throughout the GA most helpful, you know, because it all becomes a big blur at the end, is to put it into action. You know, what are the couple of key takeaways, and it might be this bureaucracy busters, for instance, that you want to remember and think about acting upon. So while Amy, right, while Amy is asking her question and the panel is going to answer, Karen is handing out accountability card or an action step. So, you know, take a moment while you're in this moment of something that you want to bring home and think about, and I encourage you to fill that out. Now, Amy,
so
please ask your quick question.
I hope it was worth waiting
for. It was worth, I'm sure.
So I was very interested in everything that the panel had to offer. I am actually a lay leader, but on my day job, I do a lot around associate engagement. What I find really fascinating is trying to translate that into the nonprofit world where the engagement of the community matters as well. So are you also thinking about metrics? Because the inside the organization can only be as successful, I believe, as the support they get from the community they're trying to serve. So if that's not a piece of the assessment that you're creating, I'm wondering if that's been given any thought.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely one of the things. We believe, you know, there's kind of a chicken and egg situation, right? So, like, there's recruitment and retention. What comes first, right? So we believe, actually, making your organization a great place to work, so you're retaining, and then that will actually drive recruitment. And then there's like a virtual cycle, basically, because you're already, I mean, kind of as Mimi said, you've got a certain amount of momentum. You're seeing people who are like, all right, you know what, actually the sands are shifting in a way that I'm actually curious and I want to be part of this process. So that's absolutely one of the things that we're looking at. And much more, because the internal has been neglected for such a long time, much more thinking about, you know, in some cases it's kind of like, you know, how do you go about kind of doing remodeling in a house, right? So, like, sometimes you do, like, the external, and it's fantastic. You got curb appeal. And we're talking about maybe, like, let's focus on the bathroom, you know? But thinking about the internal and external, making sure they're aligned also, because to Scott's point of the BS meter, you know, if there isn't that authenticity and alignment there, that also can, you know, be a barrier.
Well, engagement drives everything. I mean, we're not, the philanthropy part of our business, that's not our mission. That's just a way to get things done. And if you look at the correlation, there was a study that Indiana University and I think Jewish Jumpstart did a year ago, 2 years ago. If you zero out for age and wealth, the single biggest driver of successful philanthropy was engagement. So it's you have to measure it, and you have to set goals and stretch goals, or they're not going to hit it. So that has to be a big part of your discussion, not just dollars, it's identity, you know.
It was worth waiting for it. Thank you. It was a good question. Thank you very much for coming. I thank the members of our panel. Thank you so much. And hope this is the start of a conversation.